The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
My next guest is a double Pulitzer Fiction Prize-winning author. Irish readers may know him best for The Underground Railroad, his fictional account of the route Southern slaves undertook to reach freedom. His new book is called Cool Machine. It's just been published. It's the final book in his highly entertaining Harlem trilogy. Colson Whitehead, good morning and welcome to our program.
Hey, howdy.
Now, first of all, it's a trilogy. Can I start with Cool Machine and work my way backwards, or should I go back to the beginning?
They're all meant to stand alone, and so, but I think they gain power together, so they can start wherever you like and find your own route through.
Now, the main character throughout the trilogy is Ray Carney. Can you tell us something of him? Now, I must point out that our listeners will think, with a name like Ray Carney, that he's got to be Irish and therefore and therefore white, but he's not.
No, I think, yeah, I think probably some black Irish right here. But I wanted a single syllable and then two syllables. And I was thinking Art Carney is a cool name and then Ray Carney. And so that's the origin.
So tell us about him. He's a man of two sides, a public and a private side.
Yeah, he's a fence. And so a fence is someone who takes stolen goods and then recirculates them into legit society. And I was doing some research, and a lot of fences will have a storefront where they sell real goods like furniture or electronics. And then in the back, they'll do their illicit business. And to me, that spoke to a divided self, a split psychology. And so he's someone who wants to be an upstanding citizen, a family man, but there's a voice in the back of his head who's always saying, let's do some crimes.
Now, the book has so many hugely entertaining vignettes. And at the beginning of the book, he's being interviewed by someone for the I suppose you'd call it the rag that touts the goods of Sterling Furniture. He is salesman of the month. And Chinless Wonder comes along to interview him so he can be profiled. And it's an extraordinary encounter because the questions are asked by the Chinless Wonder and then answered audibly in one way, but mentally in quite another.
Yeah, it's a very interior novel. You know, Ray Carney, sort of an amusing guy, amusing character, and there's a real difference between what he's processing in the world and what he thinks inside. And so he's doing this interview, and he's answering these questions truthfully, but also he's reliving his criminal past. And he does that a lot. He's always sort of seeing the truth behind things when he's talking.
And the kid asks, a moment when you were tested? And he's thinking, I'm a black man in America. What? When was he not being tested?
Yeah, it's a constant barrage of challenges. So he part of the pleasure of writing Ray Carney is that he's always, you know, struggling to rise to the occasion.
Now, my introduction to the New York underworld was courtesy of an uncle many, many years ago. As a child, he handed me a well-worn copy of Damon Runyon's Penguin paperback, Guys and Dolls. And I had that impression of the New York underworld. The impression that your books give me is quite different from Damon Runyon's take.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm writing 100 years into the crime narrative tradition, and so I'm having a lot of fun with, you know, stock characters and stereotypes and conventions. So the Underground Railroad was, you know, was quite serious, and in this book I'm definitely trying to lighten the tone a bit and have some fun and tell some jokes. And a lot of the butt of the jokes are the criminals in Harlem.
Now, it's been said of your book that you could reconstruct the New York of the 1970s and 80s by simply reading the book. You'd get a sense of New York. And I suppose New York is kind of a character in the book. And you remark that New York is a city of churn.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always found it a cliche when a book critic says, you know, the city is almost a character, like Dublin and Ulysses is almost a character. It just seemed very lazy. But then halfway through the first book, Harlem Shuffle, I realized, dang it, you know, the city is a character. And so I leaned into it. And definitely, you know, as I follow Ray Carney over 30 years, we get that history of the city as well for 30 years.
Because the city is changing. I mean, it's at the beginning, it's happening at the end, I suppose, again, invoking the Irishness of New York. It was the Tammany Hall city run by Irish, be they straight or be they crooks. They ran the place, but their influence was waning.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a new dog on the block. But the main thing that remains the same is corruption. So definitely, it's not a Valentine to New York. There's a big body count, but I am trying to capture some of the secret energies behind the city, and a lot of that is criminal energy.
And a city in churn, it's in churn both from in terms of its demographics and the changing migrations to the great city of New York, but also physically churning because things get knocked down sometimes terribly on 9/11, but sometimes quite deliberately in an attempt to reinvigorate the city.
Yeah, churn is a metaphor throughout the book, and then there's destructive churn. You know, the Twin Towers are a recurring motif, and we see them before they were built. We see the crater that was made during excavation, and then we see, the Twin Towers later. And then there's also the churn of generations. And so Harlem was a white neighborhood first. It was a haven for Irish, German, and Jewish immigrants. It became a black neighborhood. And now, 120 years later, the descendants of those Irish, German, and Jewish immigrants have come to gentrify Harlem. And so churn is also generational change and the living dynamism of the city.
There's one little tiny detail in the opening chapters of your book. It's about when Ray Carney goes to visit a guy, and it's all about a piece of jewelry that has been stolen and needs to be fenced. But he remarks that on one side, there's a guy who processes visa applications for Albanians.
Sure, there's a New York is a haven for everybody.
But I was thinking, was that the kind of sowing the seeds of what is now known to be the Albanian mafia in New York? Like, you know now in 2026 that it's there, but no one knew about it back in the 1980s.
Sure, no, it is. There's a lot of foreshadowing of different things in the city, and definitely the rise of the Russian and Albanian gangs are in there.
Now, you mentioned in passing there Ulysses, and it said that, in 1904, the city of Dublin was described effectively in the wonderful book that is Ulysses, that you could reconstruct it from reading the book. You actually read Ulysses, and I also discovered that you read the Odyssey and Ulysses not quite at one sitting, but sequentially.
Well, yeah, I was taking my first trip out of the country, and I was a pretentious 20-something, so I figured, why not bring Ulysses and the Odyssey? And, as someone who loves to write about cities, obviously Ulysses is a great master text, and the same way that Stephen and Bloom are walking through the city, processing it and projecting their consciousness onto the city, so is Ray Carney. And so both those novels are great walking novels, people who love the cities and are sort of contemplating who they are and the city around them.
Now, the question of being black in America is a constant one. There was a kind of a honeymoon period, maybe, when we all believed that things had changed. I suppose the last couple of years particularly have shown dramatically that life is still very difficult. And, you talk about Ray's wife looking for a bank loan, and even black banks are turning her down. I think things might have improved a bit, but not as much as one might have hoped.
Well, I'm talking about race and class, and also in terms of Ray's wife, Elizabeth, her feminist journey. Yeah, you could not get a credit card in the 70s unless it was in your husband's name. And you could definitely, not get a loan unless your husband co-signed it. And so, I am trying to do a full portrait of America in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that includes Elizabeth's struggles as a woman entrepreneur in a sexist society.
But some things never change. I'm reading about the contract for the Blue Angels flight suits. It had been a contract awarded to a black woman, a sole trader in a little shop called The Sewing Box, and she had the patterns and she had all the rest of it. And then without telling her, they put it out to tender and they awarded it to a company hundreds of miles away at a multiple cost to compared to what she'd been earning.
Well, I talked about, you know, the corruption in New York City. That's a constant. And definitely we've hit a high watermark in terms of corruption now. You know, Pete Hegseth is purging the military of people of color, of women. It's this very systematic white supremacist mission. And so you mentioned a couple years ago, it seemed like things were getting better racially in America. I mean, I never signed off on that. Post-raciality was always a really fake notion. Just because we elect a black president doesn't mean that 60 million racists suddenly have their minds changed. And so we definitely have slid back, you know, horrendously the last couple of years.
And can you explain the election of Barack Obama, which would run counter to what we're seeing of America today? I mean, even when they're discussing candidates, they're saying, you know, a Jewish person can never be president. A woman can never be president. A gay man can never be president. A black man will not be president again anytime soon.
Well, yeah, and it was surprising that we elected a black person, definitely, you know, in 2008. I think that half the country is a bunch of morons, racists, and imbeciles. And there's another half that's really reasonable and wants a better future. And both sides are fighting, and sometimes one side wins. And we have to be very vigilant to protect our freedoms, because they'll be taken away by malevolent and evil-minded administration if we're not careful.
Now, you sound very cheerful, you know, with the prospect of all sorts of wars.
You asked me.
All sorts of wars escalating and the security of the globe under threat. I mean, is this a moment in time that can be reversed, do you think? Or has the presidency, the second term of Donald Trump, just revealed something about America that had been quite successfully obscured by many American presidents hitherto?
I don't think it was obscured. I think it was always there. I took a trip with my son, who's 12 years old. He's a big military nut. He's always like, can I get that Churchill biography for Christmas? And so for his birthday, we went to Normandy, and we visited the battle sites and the memorials and museums. And I think if we could reconnect to some of that anti-fascist sentiment, if we could reconnect with the spirit of those young men who sacrificed themselves, I think we'd be in a much better place. So it was a family trip, but I think it really did reinstill my faith in us.
And what was his reaction when you saw the rows and rows and rows of crosses? And, you know, what was his reaction when he realized these were all dead soldiers?
Well, I think, you know, he was very moved, and I was very moved. I think we've come to a place where we used to persecute and punish Nazis, and now we elect them to higher office. And I think if we went back to persecuting and punishing them, we'd be in a better place.
Question, if your son, who's a military nut, as you put it, if he decided, I want to join up, what would you say?
He's, yeah, I don't know, we'll have to see. He's definitely more of like a naval intelligence kind of guy. so I don't think he'd be on the front lines.
Okay. It strikes me when I'm talking to you about your books that you are a purveyor of literary fiction. I mean, your books are highly entertaining and diverting and amusing, but, you know, they are still literary. What do you think defines that genre? We can look at Hamlet and say, yes, that's literary fiction. I can look at Cool Machine and say, that is literary fiction. What defines that genre from The Potboiler, the number one of the fiction charts of the New York Times?
I think that, you know, I'm not really hung up on labels and genre labels. I think there's two kinds of genres, stuff you like and stuff you don't like. And mm-hmm. So I think that my stuff is, you know, I try to make my stuff well-written and entertaining and also worth your while. And is that literary or not literary? That's really up to you. If it's your taste, that's great. And then if not, the libraries and bookstores are full of stuff that's maybe up your alley.
Well, it's certainly up my alley. Colson Whitehead, author of the newest book in the trilogy, Cool Machine. Colson, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.